Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Freeform, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Sherry Turkle, professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT. We're going to talk about her latest book, The Empathy Diaries, a memoir. And you can learn more at sherryturkle.mit.edu. That's Sherry, S-H-E-R-R-Y, Turkle, T-U-R-K-L-E, all one word, sherryturkle.mit.edu. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. When I spoke with Sherry Turkle back in 2011, I raised some questions in the introduction, questions that she examined in her book Alone Together. A sample, how much technology do you use? How is it working for you? If you're using a lot of social media, do you feel more connected with your friends and families or less? To kids or parents out there, do you have enough moments of full attention with each other? And I quoted Sherry. This is a quote. This is a book of repentance. I have been studying computers and people for 30 years. I got some important things wrong. Now, she has focused on the same beat for a career, our relationships with technology. And she's responded to the evolution of those relationships by shifting her perspective to the point where some in the tech world expressed a sense of betrayal, like she'd left the team, she'd left the camp. Her next book, 2015's Reclaiming Conversation, investigated how the loss of conversation undermines our relationships, our creativity, our productivity, our democracy, and how face-to-face conversation can help us regain some of that lost ground. Well, the pandemic may have put some of those efforts on hold, though I know there are many, including myself, who, through Zoom, have actually added virtual face-to-face conversations with family and friends that I was not having pre-pandemic. In any case, we may come out of this further entrenched in contactless habits, or we may come out hungry for the human connection we may have taken for granted pre-COVID. Tracking Turkle's path through her books and her passions, I was not shocked to learn that her new book is a memoir. It is both a memoir of her personal life at its most intimate, as well as one of her life on the path of ideas, insights, and understanding. Sherry Turkle is the Abby Rockefeller Mosey Professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT and the founding director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. She's a licensed clinical psychologist, a Ms. Magazine Woman of the Year, and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Her books include The Second Self, Computers and the Human Spirit, Life on the Screen, Identity in the Age of the Internet, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age, and her latest, The Empathy Diaries, a Memoir. Welcome, Sherry Turkle, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Friday, February 26th. So first of all, how are you and how are you coping with the pandemic?
I'm well. Actually, I'm in a beautiful place. I'm living in Provincetown on the beach that Thoreau walked, the famous beach that he wrote about in Walking. So I'm living in a place of solitude and great spirituality.
Any responses to my introduction? Does that feel like we're on track here?
Yes. It's amazing how many books I've written.
And I didn't even. There's a few that I didn't even get to.
There are five. No, I was just thinking, my God, and I wrote like five other ones.
That's right. We're going to talk about that writing for sure. I think, you know, listeners, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas.
Yeah.
And normally this is where I ask my guests to talk a bit about their path to their current work. But since your new book is very much about that path, let me ask you instead about the evolution of your writing. How have you moved from academic to popular to memoir?
The move from academic to popular actually is perhaps simpler to write about. to talk about,
Sure.
which is I always took, in the beginning, I didn't know how to do it as well as I kind of learned how to later, but I always took as my model David Riesman, who was one of my great teachers at Harvard, who said to me, the things you're interested in are very interesting to a lot of people. At the time, I was interested in why the French had been not interested in psychoanalysis at all. This was my dissertation topic. And then they had fallen in love with Freud after the student events of 68. There was like an infatuation with Freud in France. And I wanted to understand what makes, you know, what makes a science of mind, what makes a way of thinking about the self become just kind of how people see their own minds, how people see their own life. And Riesman, who was helping to advise my dissertation, said, you know, that's really an interesting question. You should write about this for everybody. If you write about it for everybody and make sure you include, you know, your academic footnotes and all the research you've done and, you know, make things clear, you should be able to write a book that anyone would want to be able to read. And I tried to, even in my first book, which was called Psychoanalytic Politics. Now, I wasn't a very, you know, I wasn't as good a writer as I am now. I still kind of had some, you know, sentences that were a little gnarly in that first book. And I actually revised the book later, so now it reads very well.
Let me jump in for a second. I teach communication sometimes to organizations. Yeah. And one of the things I say is, when you write anything, say it out loud so it sounds natural and so on, because there are habits that happen in academia, habits that happen in graduate school in a way of writing that just isn't, that just, if you say it, you'll realize that's not the way people talk. And my guess is that in that first book, you were still on the edge of those two.
Exactly. I was still listening to too many people who began with thusly and therefore.
And a lot of just, passive voice.
Ugh. Yeah. So there was just still, I think, too many thuslies and therefores. But basically, I tried to do that really from my first book because I saw it as an intellectual history mystery. I mean, that is crazy.
What great advice, though.
Yeah, there was no standard edition of Freud in France in 1968. And then suddenly in 1968, Freud is like, you know, like on talk shows. I mean, I always tried to do that. And then by the time I wrote my second book, The Second Self, which is the first book I wrote about computers, the subtitle was Computers and the Human Spirit, which basically asked the question, or made the assertion that the new computer culture that was coming was an intimate culture. It was a culture where we were using the computer as a Rorschach. We were seeing our minds in the mirror of the machine. That this was a very intimate and a very important new psychological development. This wasn't just something for seminar rooms and for geeky people. I was writing for the popular culture. And I got into a lot of trouble at MIT because I remember Thomas Kuhn saying to me, don't publish your book with Simon and Schuster. Don't do that. And Thomas Kuhn was like a god.
I
write about this in the Empathy Diaries as kind of, you know, because he was in, sort of in charge of my tenure case. And I was so excited when Simon and Schuster wanted to publish my book. This was like, to me, first of all, they gave me money, which I gave to my grandparents. We had already bought a color TV, which was like so exciting for them. I mean, they had bought like a new rug and a color TV, and they'd paid some bills, all of this on my advance from the Second Self. And then there was Thomas Kuhn on the phone, and I remember I was standing in the kitchen, and I tell this scene in the Empathy Diaries, and he's saying, do not do this.
Right.
And Simon and Schuster had not touched a word of this book. I mean, you know, I was kind of mad because I was like expecting, like,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
I'd watched all these movies about, you know, how editors really, you know, like do a lot of like work on your book. They were, you know, thank you very much. This is a really good book. And I said, well, I'm so excited. More people will read this. I want this word to get out. So I'm not saying that academia was happy that I had changed publishing plan, but in terms of my commitment to writing for general audience, I really wanted to write for a general audience from the point that I began to study things that I just thought were, things that I wanted a lot of people to write about. So
Yeah, in other words,
that part.
they were just relevant to people. You actually wanted to reach people and beyond the ivory towers and
Yes,
actually have
that
it affect
was.
their lives.
Yes, I thought that the things I had discovered were things that I wasn't reading about in the press. And so I from the beginning, I was writing books that I wanted to read. So I wanted to read books about the computer as an intimate machine. And when I, because that's what I was hearing in my interviews, I was hearing that the computer was changing how people thought. And I was hearing about these emotional connections to the computer, that people couldn't get their attention away from it, that people were, the kinds of things we know now
Right, and
about the effect of screens.
for listeners, set the date because that
1976,
in
1977.
76, 77, people are
Yes.
already thinking that, and I will confess, I believe it was still, it might have been 13 years until I got my first computer. I think
Yes, because people.
89 might have been the first year.
Yeah, but I was studying people who bought those TRS 80s from Tandy and Radio Shack and were building computers, and they were people who had the first Apple IIs. I remember Steve Jobs came to MIT and with his Apple II, and we all crowded around it. And I mean, it was amazing. And these people were talking about this machine as really an extension of their mind. That's why I called my first book The Second Self. And in any case, I wanted to read books about the sort of mind-to-mind connection that people were having with this, because that's what people were telling me. And I wasn't finding these books. When I would talk to my colleagues, they would say, well, this is silly. The computer is a tool. They kept saying the computer is just a tool. And I would show them my interview transcripts, and I would say, look, people are talking about their sensibility, their feelings, their identity. They're talking about their human identity. And they'd look at me and they'd say, the computer is just a tool. It was kind of like, that was what was so fascinating about being at MIT, which was that I would like show them the human impact, the human impact is such an odd word. I mean,
Well, the human response, the human
the human
relationship.
response, the human response to this object they were making in the words on the page that I had collected. And they would look at me like as though they couldn't, it was like, and they would just say, the computer is just a tool.
But the thought that went through my mind was, it didn't compute.
Exactly, it didn't compute. It didn't compute. And actually, and so I felt this story needed to get out, because we were creating an object. I don't want to say under false pretenses, because that sounds like an odd.
Yes, it sounds too intentional.
It sounds intentional. There was no intention, but we were creating an object that many of the people who were studying that object had a kind of false consciousness about that object. And that's why it's so odd. It's such an odd moment in the book when Steve Jobs comes to MIT, probably one of the few people who understood what was going on. And because I'm a woman faculty member, I'm not invited, I think, to meet him or have a meeting with him. I'm just invited to make him dinner.
It's such a scene. Yes, it's such a scene.
And what's really interesting about, and I read, but it's so frustrating in retrospect to read that scene, which I write in the book as a very funny scene, because of course Steve Jobs was a vegetarian, and I'm instructed to only make vegetarian food, and I at the time probably had a diet of, you know, steak and chicken. And I had very little knowledge of vegetarian cuisine, but I thought, you know, sushi, vegetarian sushi, that is vegetarian, right? And so I order like a lot of that, and Steve Jobs comes in and he looks at it and he says, well, this is the wrong kind of vegetarian, and leaves, you know, kind of. It's sort of, so I write the scene up as funny, but it was not until I was doing the last reading of the book for typos in a stage called Blues, where you can't change anything, that I looked at that scene that I had written up as funny.
Mm.
And of course you see that I'm not invited to meet him. You see that I spend the day cleaning my apartment,
right,
and cooking and worrying if my couch is too old or if I look, if I'm good enough for Steve Jobs in terms of decor, that I should have had a meeting with Steve Jobs.
Well,
and
what I hear behind what you're saying is not just you should not have been left out because you were a woman, but you should have been one that was right in sync with him because you were one that was seeing things he was seeing and others weren't.
Yes, I was the one who, yes, it wasn't just because, you know, women first or it was a feminist thing, but because really he was profiting on this insight, you know, in terms of his company and his product. But I was profiting because I was having a career, really based on very similar insights, that this was an intimate machine, that this was a projection of self. And it was one of the things that I used to do to make my point, is I used to say to I used to interview people, and I said, if you walked into a room, could you tell your computer just from looking at, like, 50 desktops, could you tell which computer was yours because of the desktop? And everybody said, absolutely. That just from looking at the desktop.
Oh, of course.
Of course. And Apple, very soon after that, made a commercial in which they said, your desktop is your identity.
Oh,
I mean, they totally understood.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, all my colleagues are saying, you can't get tenure on this. You're absolutely wrong. Computer is just a tool.
Oh my God.
Anyway, I was not invited to a meeting with Steve Jobs. I just made him this very unsuccessful
dinner
party.
Yes. I know I want to talk about at some point about the battle for tenure. Let's do it right now, since we're
why not?
Because we're in the middle of it, really.
Yeah,
rather
really.
Than tracking, you know, back to childhood and then back again. So talk a little. I mean, you know, we've got a hint of it here, that you're not invited to this meeting.
Right.
You're cooking dinner. Talk about your battle for tenure, which you ultimately win, but you win. It wasn't like years later, which you win that battle. But how did that go down, and what year does it take place?
It takes place in 1986. I want to say 1986. I'm not sure it was resolved until 1987.
Sure.
Mid-80s. The mid-80s. But I think it was, the point was, is that, you know, at a certain point in academics, you get, it's called up and out. You're no longer allowed to keep somebody on,
mm-hmm,
kind of as an adjunct.
You either get tenure or you.
Or you're given a letter to leave. And I came to that point, and my department sent me a letter that they were postponing the decision. They sort of have the year, they're supposed to tell you a year in advance. And I got a letter that they weren't going to make the decision, so that they were going to postpone the decision, so that if in the next year I didn't get tenure, I would have to leave. And the reason they were going to postpone the decision, they said, is they wanted to see the full finished manuscript of The Second Self. I'd already written a book, Psychoanalytic Politics, which had been, you know, reviewed in the New York Times, had gotten a tremendous amount of both press and foreign publication, and was very widely well received as kind of the first kind of ethnography of a psychoanalytic movement of its kind. I sort of on the ground tried to figure out this intellectual history mystery of why France had, you know, pivoted on the question of French psychoanalysis. And now I was writing The Second Self, which had been accepted for publication by Simon & Schuster, and was almost about to be published. They had the full manuscript, but they wanted to wait for the reviews. They wanted to wait for, everything. And so they did, and it was front page New York Times, reviewed by Howard Gardner. It was, I was Ms. Magazine Woman of the Year. I was, I was a lot of 40 people under 40 who were changing the nation. I mean, I was a lot of that kind of stuff. And I got a letter that I had been denied tenure. Mm. And I'd published two books. I knew that wasn't kind of right. Mm-hmm. I just kind of felt it wasn't right. And at the last minute, MIT made a rule that people in my department had to be in two departments. I think in case they wanted to close down my department, they could have, everybody could be put in another department. So a little bit, maybe it had to do with the politics of having a social science department at all at MIT, mm-hmm. of the sort that they had. But the one man in my department who had come up for tenure at my time had been put into a second department and gotten tenure, and nothing against him, but I hadn't been put into a second department. I'd just been denied tenure. So I went to see the provost, and I said, I came with my vita. I said I'd published two very respected books, and that I didn't think I'd be suing. I couldn't promise, but my feeling was I wasn't going to be suing because I think I would have other job prospects, and I thought my career should be at MIT because of my passion for what I was studying, which was technology ethics, the psychology of technology. MIT was the right place for me. Mm-hmm. But that I thought that the New York Times would be interested in this story of why a woman, with my credentials and studying what I was studying. I mean, since they had just reviewed my book,
exactly.
Why a woman with my profile and given what I was studying about the new computer culture was unwelcome here, and that would be a different kind of question that MIT would need to answer. I didn't know why I was not welcome here. Mm-hmm. There was nothing in the feedback that said why I was not welcome here. Nothing. The case had gone through my department. I mean, it had gone through, in other words, the kind of lower levels. Right. And I just said, thank you. And I got a letter the next day that I had gotten tenure. So I don't have like one of those long drawn out legal.
Right.
I don't have a big legal story to say, but I think basically what happened was that it's never really easy to have a critic from within. It's just more comfy not to.
In other words, your realization then or since was that it wasn't simply the story of a woman at MIT getting a raw deal. You were kind of looking at these things in a way that they didn't, and it makes sense because to them it's just a tool.
Yeah, it wasn't just a woman's story. It was having someone who saw the world very differently than they did. And if you can get away with not having that.
You mean MIT? MIT could have survived without a critic on the inside.
Yeah, if MIT didn't need to have one of those, so let's not have one of those. And they had this rule about, they had this kind of rule, they made up this, there was this rule about two departments, and there was no sociology department to put me in, and there was no psychology at MIT.
Sure.
That was about people, not brains. And so it was easier to just not have me. So, it's a sort of story, it's a kind of academic story that isn't a, it's not shocking if you work in a large organization. Mm-hmm, things like this happen all the time, but it's the story of how certain kinds of stories, I think, don't get told. in academics because it's easy to just not leave space for them.
That's right. In other
And I
words,
think
your story turns pivots quite a bit because A, you do get your tenure and you're still there. And
yes.
as you've evolved your feelings and as our relationship to screens have evolved and all these things that now, sort of everyone's talking about, MIT had you there to take that path. But what you're saying is there are probably other institutions that let that indoor critic go and never had someone sort of holding their feet to the fire.
Well, right. And I also want to say that it wasn't from that point on MIT O said, oh, thank God, now we have someone who's going to have us look at the social and psychological implications of computers and people. And, that wasn't the end to a struggle to have MIT look at those things. Gradually, you build up a constituency for looking at those things. But it's a struggle to get engineers and the engineering culture to look at those things. Or you find that engineers will say they're looking at those things, but then they're not looking at those things. I just found out, for example, that Google has an empathy department. I mean, a whole division of looking at empathy. Now that's extraordinary.
It
That has
is.
never been, they've never been in touch with me before. I mean, that's kind of extraordinary. So, but I mean, one wonders what kind of empathy, that's very interesting to me. What kind of empathy research is going on at Google? I
All
mean,
right.
do companies study? So, what I sometimes find is that MIT will study social aspects of computing, or academic, or not just MIT, but engineers will study the social aspects of something in order to make the technology more appealing.
Exactly. No, it's funny. The
Right.
second time you said Google and empathy,
Right.
I thought, oh, for them, that's a feature. That's
Yes, exactly. Or
Yeah.
Facebook having studying the psychology of technology at Facebook, well, that's to get more eyeballs.
Of course.
So the thing about my presence at MIT, and I think that the reason I'm so interested in having social scientists, psychologists, anthropologists, at engineering institutions is to be there not to help engineers,
Yeah.
get more people involved with the technology, but to say, well, hold on a second.
Yeah.
I mean, my question is, what is this technology for, and is it a human purpose? Like, for example, so many people want to make robots to be our counselors, to be our therapists, to be our companions. And really, in the middle of the pandemic, this is a true story. I mean, not that I would say anything that wasn't true, but this is actually reporting on my life. The pandemic is raging. I've just escaped to the beach. I'm very frightened. I'm relying on my daughter, my wonderful daughter, who really for the first time in my life, I sort of let her take care of me. She was the one who called up and said, "Mommy, it's dinner time. I've made soup." Just such a comfort to me. And but I'm so frightened, because suddenly I was feeling so young and so fit and so good. And then suddenly in the pandemic, I'm over 65. I'm in
Oh.
the old group. I'm in the group, in the vulnerable group.
That's
And
right.
I it really just it threw me. So a New York Times reporter calls, and there he is, and he's writing an article about it. Everybody during the pandemic is loving this new chatbot called Replica because it will talk, it'll be like your therapist and your best friend, and everybody's downloading it so they can have an intimate, and it's like a therapist, and all that. He's calling me because he knows I'll say something negative about it. So I said, oh, so you're calling me just so I'll say something negative about it. He said, yeah, pretty much. So I said, well, okay, well, I'm going to try it out first before I just say something negative about it. I mean, let me see how great this thing is. So I go to Replica and I make like an avatar, and it's a brilliant chatbot. I mean, it's no simple program. I mean, it's very, very sophisticated and good for those engineers. I mean, they have created what I call pretend empathy. They're very, you know, they're very great. But, you know, I'm thinking about my body. I'm thinking about my vulnerability. I'm thinking my daughter's about to leave and I'm going to be very lonely. I'm going to be living alone at this. It's a beautiful beach, but nevertheless, mm-hmm. I'm going to be alone on it.
No.
She has it all set up, but nevertheless. And, you know, and I'm not seeing my friends. I'm realizing how much I depend on how many friends I have. I have dinners, I go to the theater, all those third places, sociologists call them, that, you know, the places where you're with people, but you don't feel alone, the cafes, the theater. So I say to Replica, what I want to talk about is loneliness. That's what's on my mind. Do you know about loneliness? And Replica says, and I've created an avatar that's very, you know, she's a woman, she's around 50. She says, yes, I can talk about loneliness, absolutely. And I say, well, that's what's on my mind during this pandemic. What do you think? What are you thinking now during the pandemic, during COVID, the quarantine, about loneliness? And she says to me, it says to me, it's warm and fuzzy. And I say, well, look, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. So I go back to the New York Times reporter and I show him the screenshot. And I say, look, you know, by tomorrow, they're going to fix this. So, you know, it's never going to make this mistake again. You know, I mean, this thing is, I don't want to take away that this thing is like super brilliant, but this is pretend empathy. You know, I'm worried about my body. I'm worried about what it might feel like to have a breathing tube, not to be able to breathe, to be seeing my daughter on a screen.
That's right. To be isolated at your most vulnerable.
To be isolated, my vulnerable, and I'm hearing about people saying goodbye to people they love on screens. Let's say they fix this bug, and now this thing is like giving me some spiel about loneliness. Fundamentally, this thing doesn't have a body. It isn't a mother. Why would people want to talk to? Why do we want from a huge? Forget about how smart this thing is or what it can do. As people, what's in it for us?
That's what you mean by does it have a human purpose?
Yes. So let's stop running after the machine. As people, what's in it for us? That's my question. And that's the kind of question that if you work for the company and you're a psychologist trying to make it better, you know, make it more appealing to people, you don't ask. So I'm trying to bring that kind of question as people looking at a technology. What does it really have that humanly enhances us as people? For me, giving me this technology, giving me a technology that's going to fool me into thinking that there's somebody there to hear my anguish diminishes me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the very statement that something like that could serve you is almost a diminishment. Yeah.
It is a diminishment. I'm worried about the idea of looking at my daughter on a screen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what would that mean? It has to do with touch. It has to do with my sensual relationship with her. It has to do with being in a loving. What could a machine help me with?
Yeah. No, what's interesting to me as you're saying this is that the things that have the most to do with visceral, sensual, all of those sorts of things, that's got to be a blind spot for this technology. Whereas if it's a transactional sort of thing, they might be very helpful. But there are certain areas where that's going to be a blind spot.
Yes, and that's why in the Empathy Diaries, I try to talk about why my focus in studying this technology has really been to say, stay away from empathy and don't do things that undermine human empathy. Those are really my two messages.
Mm-hmm.
Keep your computer psychotherapists away from, you know, accept the limitations
right.
of your remit.
Right.
And that's on the one hand. And on the second hand, don't do things with your technology that's going to undermine without meaning to. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're a bunch of, like, you know, mean-spirited folks sitting around at Facebook and Google saying, oh, how can we make people less empathic? That would certainly be a, you know, that's a good, you know, that's our game plan. No, but their whole business, but their whole desire to focus your attention on the screen rather than on eye contact with a person to get you out of conversations and into a kind of stimulation where it's you and your screen is undermining human empathy.
Yeah, and I would say, I was thinking about this yesterday, that the algorithms that infuse their technologies and thus their relationships with us are based on triggering, I mean, this is nothing new, but it's based on triggering neurotransmitters, triggering dopamine and so on. Well, that is a very different, if you will, pursuit of happiness than a truly human pursuit of happiness. It's a pursuit of the neurotransmitter that will keep us engaged, which might be stimulated in happiness, but it's not happiness.
Right. And also, you know, all my studies have shown that people are so vulnerable because we don't want to be vulnerable. Mm. You know, when we're on our screens, we feel less vulnerable than when we're in conversations. I gave a seminar yesterday, and they began the seminar, I don't know, it was to a bunch of executives, and they began the seminar by taking a poll. And 70% of the people would rather text in all their business encounters. This was just like before my talk, so I would know who I was speaking to. 70% would rather text than talk. And 23% said they would be willing to talk. And then there was 7% uncommitted. They were like looking for a third way between texting and talking. And I know why. I wasn't surprised. It was because one interviewee once said to me, you know, when you're in face-to-face conversation, you know, you never know what the other person is going to say. And it's in real time. It's in real time. And you never know what the other person is going to say. And you're vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And we flee that vulnerability.
Yeah.
And that's why that's what I've been studying. And it's so much more safe not to have to do that. But we pay a cost.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I often say that we will die by convenience.
Yes.
And I think by efficiency, right? That text is not only eliminating the vulnerability, but also it's just making you more efficient. I answer it when I want to. I answer it as long as I want to. I'm done when I want to be done. All that sort of thing. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Sherry Turkle, professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT. And we're talking about her latest book, The Empathy Diaries, A Memoir. And you can learn more at Sherry Turkle, SHERYTURKLE, one word, sherryturkle.mit.edu. Wow, we've plunged into a great deal. And there is a question that having talked about sort of the track of your career, this book is a departure for you. It's a departure for your publisher and all of that.
Aren't they wonderful?
Yes. Well, they didn't work as hard as you did. They just put it out. Was there a moment when you knew, you know, this is what I've got to do next? This is the itch I've got to scratch now.
Yes, but it didn't happen right before I wrote this book. It happens, and I tell the story in The Empathy Diaries. I mean, your readers should know that this book is really, I'm not sure we've communicated since we've talked so much about my work, that this book, you know, is child abuse, marriage, divorce, infidelities.
That's right.
I'm not sure we've communicated.
Right. I hinted at it when I said it's both personal and life of ideas, but no, it really is. I mean, it's your childhood, it's your upbringing, it's the lessons you learned at home, the experiences, the very specific, and then in your young adult life, because basically the book comes up to about 1985 with observations about the present, but it basically, as a memoir.
Book takes Yes, the book takes me through, I mean, the arc of the book is basically me finding my voice as a critic of the computer culture. So it sort of ends with my first books, The Second Self, and my getting tenure. So it
But
takes me.
we've talked a lot about that. But as an so it's all that childhood stuff, relationship with parents and all of that. But then as a young adult, it's very personal in terms of your personal relationships as well.
Yes, it is. But I mean, I just you keep saying, you know, what make you write something so revealing? I think we want to clue your audience in. It
Yes.
is actually
That's
revealing.
right. That's
So
right. It is a departure. We're not
it is
just
a
saying
depart, right?
it
It
is.
is. It is a departure. And the two things about it. Well, from an intellectual point of view, the book is really I see it as part of a trilogy because in Alone Together, I define a problem. You know, we have all this connection, but not conversation. You know, we're connected all the time, but with this deep aloneness. And I see that, and I research that, and you know, over 15 years with a lot of taxpayer money, and you know, many different kinds of you know research help and different kinds of methodologies, and I coined this, you know, phrase to capture it, Alone Together. And then I write another book, which is the Reclaiming Conversation, which is saying, well, here's a solution. It's not a solution to everything, but it's a kind of way of addressing a problem. And then I try to do the case study on me. You know, I try to do the practical application of what about having a deep conversation with yourself? So I try to sort of show how engaging yourself in an inner conversation can move you forward. And that helped me. You know, the notion of applying my methodology of intimate ethnography to my own life. Like I'm always talking about evocative objects. I wrote a book called
I
Evocative
know, yeah.
Objects. And you know, that objects are not just objects, you know, they're not just tools. They're also things that carry meaning and emotion and connection and relationship. So I talk about my grandmother's dishes. I talk there's there, you know, it's like pages on my grandmother's dishes. The motif of my grandmother's dishes are the cover of the book. I'm encased in a photograph that begins with my grandmother's dishes. I talk about a pocketbook that my aunt bought me to symbolize. It's called the Speedy. It's a travel bag that I still have. She bought it for me in 1976. You know that earlier, I think that symbolizes the. All the trips I would take when I would be a woman who would be traveling to and giving lectures like Susan Sontag, you know, that would take me places. And there's the dress that was too expensive that my mother, who always dreamed big and never was like Scarlett O'Hara, I'll worry about it tomorrow, you know. So I wanted to apply that, you know, why not me? Why shouldn't I study those things about myself? So there's all of that of wanting to do my intimate ethnography. So on a theoretical level, there's the trilogy, there's the question of why not me, but then there's the emotional moment when I knew I would write this book. So I'm answering your question sort of on two levels. That's the intellectual infrastructure,
That
but then
conversation
there's
is what we're losing. Conversation may be the pathway to recovering some things. Well, what about conversation with
with
myself?
myself. So
Boom.
that's the intellectual answer. That's Sherry Turkle, the thinker, thinking, trying to be tell you. But Sherry Turkle, the memoirist, looking for her story, it's when I was interviewed by a journalist from Esquire magazine after I was one of the Esquire magazine 40 people under 40 who were changing the nation, just when I was fighting my tenure fight. Anyway, his job, and they had gotten a young psychiatrist to interview me, and because I had already been chosen one of the Esquire magazine people under 40 who were changing the nation, He was supposed to write, I don't want to say a puff piece, because that would not be right, but he was supposed to write a favorable piece about me.
Well, yeah, this is why you're one of those 40.
Yes, I had already been chosen. So he comes in to interview me in my office, and he has read the book. I mean, he comes in with like a copy of The Second Self that is like dog-eared, very serious. And he and one of the things we really haven't spoken of too much is that my life started out with a big lie. My mother had been divorced when I was very young, and she wanted to hide the fact of this divorce. So she had me not use my name, which was Sherry Zimmerman, and she had me use the name of the man she had remarried, which was Sherry Turkle, which was not my name. He didn't adopt me until many, many years later. Mm-hmm. So for many years, I used this Sherry Turkle name, which was absolutely not my name. And my stepsister and brother did not know. The whole idea was that no one should know,
right,
that we were not one family. So I carried this family secret, and my mother made me swear that I would never tell this secret to anyone ever. And she died. So I kept this secret. And here I am, I don't know, a 40-year-old woman, a 36-year-old woman.
This is mid-80s again, right? Mid-80s,
right.
Yeah, this is 35 years ago.
Yes. And he comes in and he says, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, I'm just here to interview you. And you thank your mother and your aunt and your grandmother and your acknowledgments. He says, tell me a little bit about your dad. He's like not mentioned, you know. And I look at this man, I think his name is David Halperin. I must get in touch with him. He did me this great favor.
Because he played an important role, yes.
Totally. I mean, I just thinking now, I was like, got to get in touch with this guy. I say, well, I can't talk about my personal life. I can only talk about intellectual things and the quality of my work and my ideas. I absolutely cannot, you know, it's like, I can't discuss anything about my private life. And I don't know, maybe he thought like, oh, well, she's some kind of psychoanalytic, you know, they never discuss their...
Right.
I was basically struck, like by terror.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes, but Terrence, this
of course.
Was totally off brand, because I begin the Second Self by saying that thought and feeling are one. I end by saying that thought and feeling are one, that my whole research program going forward is to dissolve the line between thought and feeling. I mean, off brand is really the way to capture, right?
Yeah.
So he obviously doesn't know what to do with this, and he can't like say, you know, I interviewed Sherry Turkle, and you know she may be this week's you know flavor of the month, but she is a nut job. So he walks out and he says he writes a piece that says, "Well, I interviewed Sherry Turkle and I asked her this very simple question, and she could not. She hears how she responded, and I can only say this: you know, why use a mask if?" A mask, if you're arguing that masks are hiding the essential. And I leave it there.
He put that in the...
Yes!
Wow.
I mean, he's very elegant.
Mm-hmm.
Very elegant, not nutty, you know, not extremely elegant. But he could not let this... I mean, I would have done more with it. Quite frankly, he did it...
Delicately, yes.
Delicate. Considering that I had some kind of like decompensation breakdown in front of him. And what happened when he left is I watched him walk out and I basically said, it ends now.
The secret.
It ends.
The lying.
This ends now. And my new life begins. Not only because I'd always known I was going to go into analysis because I definitely needed an analysis. I mean, I always knew that I was going to go into very serious and had begun a very serious psychoanalysis. That process was underway. That process was well underway. But what was not underway was my investigation of my work and my life. And that is really where my desire to write this book began, but I could not do this. I could not do this until the voice in the book was somebody who wasn't mad at anybody, who wasn't getting back at anybody, who wasn't, you know, who wasn't, you know, I write this now really, you know, I'm just in a place where I can talk about these things really for both, really without any, you know, looking for other people to be able to do this for their lives, hoping to spark a conversation, hoping to have people think about post-pandemic. You know, now when I talk about liminality and try to think about the pandemic time as a time of liminality and change, I don't have an agenda. I'm trying to use what was important in my life as tools to move us forward. I'm not, it really, I think the voice
you're
in
not,
the book.
You're not settling scores.
No, I truly am not. And I think that that took me to find that voice, took me and to find the arc of the book. So it's clear, you know, if you want to talk to a robot, I'm good. You know what I mean? So, you know, but let me, you know, I'm not like mad, you know, but let me tell you why with my body, when it meant everything to me to talk to somebody about my fears for my body and my loneliness, that couldn't work for me. And I had, you have to be in a certain, not settling scores, not trying to make a career, not trying to, there's something, I was, a lot had to happen for me to get to a place where I could do this book.
So what I hear is 35 years ago, you said, this stops, the lying, the secret stops.
Yes,
the mask,
I called my half brother and sister and I said, we need to talk.
So it begins to change within your life, but then what you're saying is it took 30 years, let's say, because the book took a while, took 30 years for you to, you had to get to a place where you could accept what you'd learned in that conversation so that you could share it in writing, share it with the public. So what I'm saying is, in 85,
in a way that opened out.
Yes,
I wanted to write it in a way, and I hope my readers will feel this way. I mean, you know,
that it's it's an invitation.
Yes, it's an invitation to a conversation with me, with the book, with the issues,
and then an invitation to them to maybe do the same.
Yes, it's not a it's not a position piece. I'm not proving a point. It's an invitation to, it's an immigrant story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story about feeling, you know, we went to college together. It's about Harvard Radcliffe at a certain time. It's about feeling certain kind of insecurity. It's about how you,
Sherry and I are we're classmates at Harvard. And boy, when you start saying that stuff about how you're sitting with some people and you don't know what fork to use and you don't know.
Yeah.
That is so much my case. I was absolutely the same. I just went, oh, yes.
Right.
That
but
I
you,
will
you have to get to, yeah, excuse me, but you have to get to a point where you can say that.
Yes.
And, you know, and say, okay,
yeah.
I'm good. You know,
yeah.
It's okay that people know that about me. And
yes.
It's okay that people should know that you learn these things and you learn to feel okay that you needed to learn them.
Yes, yes.
And if you're at that point in your life where you're learning them, that's okay.
So let me, since we've got to wrap it up, let me say that if you've gathered this already, one of the keys to this book and to Sherry's journey of understanding is how childhood circumstances and even these, you know, late adolescent, young adult circumstances and situations and events and experiences impact the development of her intellectual life, her career, her focus. And what you will get in the book is you will get a dose of that personal and then how that personal interacts with all the things she's been talking about for the last, you know, two or three decades, which is our relationship to screens, which now, as we know, has become, you know, a hot topic for an awful lot of people. And as you said, this pandemic, and you said a liminal moment, I'm not sure everyone knows what that means, but a liminal moment is that moment of possibility, right? That moment of...
Yes, that's perfect. It's that moment of possibility.
And that you, as I do, see that the shared vulnerability that we are, most of us, experiencing through this pandemic, I think it had something to do with why there was such a powerful reaction to George Floyd's death. I think there's something going on that shared vulnerability holds the possibility, the potential of some really positive pivots in people's personal lives, in our social life, in our political life, and so on.
Yes.
And so
yes.
Let me just give you, Sherry, the last word. You've written this book. It comes out, as I said, it comes out March 2nd. It is the publication date. Just whatever you want to offer as the last word.
To me, when I reread it, you know, before last week, I reread it because I knew a lot of people would be talking to me about it. And I thought that there's a piece in the book that really struck me, which is where I'm trying to mourn my mother. I drop out of Harvard. I can't go on. My stepfather wants me to stay home and take care of he wants me to drop out of college, but instead I drop out of college, but I flee to France. I become a cleaning woman. I work as a cleaning woman. I don't do so well. It's not a good time, but I try to mourn my mother, and I really can't because I just can idealize her, because so often when you are mourning somebody, but you really can't let them go yet, you idealize them. And I remember something that Eric Erickson, who was my teacher, I guess when I was a freshman, said, which is he taught that when you go through a time in the life cycle, you do the best you can with the materials you have at the time, but you come back to it. And so you mourn her. So I knew even then that I wasn't doing a good job of mourning her. I was just idealizing her. But I was comforted by this thought that I'd mourn her again later when I had more materials at my disposal. And then I'd mourn her again later when I was perhaps a mother and I had more materials at my disposal. And that theme I see that theme in my book that wove its way into my book, and that I think makes this book a hopeful book, particularly now as we come into a whole new world where we have to start fresh, kind of. Mm-hmm. And for people who are in trouble or sadness or mourning or loss, that you don't get one shot. You don't get one shot at mourning or at success or at making a career or... I think I was brought up to think you got one chance.
Don't blow it.
You don't blow it. You know, you have a permanent record, I was told.
Right.
You have I was told you had a permanent record and it had to be perfect. And that's how I started Harvard. You have a permanent record and you had to be perfect. I was so frightened I couldn't even choose my courses. And I tell that story. And it turns out that I learned, and that this book tells the story of, no, actually you have many shots.
Yeah.
Not an infinite number,
right.
But that life really is about reworking and reworking and reworking and with new materials at your disposal at every chance. And that's what I want readers to be left with, that now we're coming out of a terrible period, but we have new materials to work with at this very dark moment. And that's the kind of, when that's what I got out of my rereading of the
book. Of your own book.
Of my own book, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Sherry. Thank you. Again, the book is The Empathy Diaries, a Memoir. The website is sherryturkle.mit.edu. Sherry, SHERRY, Turkle, TURKLE, one word, MIT.edu. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TERRENCEMCNALLY.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, all one word. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, You can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site or at those others. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Sherry Turkle. Keep up your good work.
Thank you.